Picture Mildenhall Aerodrome before dawn on the 20th of October 1934. There's dew on the grass. Your breath makes little clouds. The smell is high-octane fuel and oil and damp English earth, and underneath all of that, something else, something that doesn't have a name. The smell of what's about to happen. 20 aircraft are lined up in the growing light, engines warming. Some crews are walking through one last pre-flight. Some are standing quietly, not talking, looking southeast in the direction they're going. In a few minutes, they will begin racing to Australia, 11,000 miles. I'm Tail Dragger. You're listening to Radio Hangar, and this is The Hangar. Today, we're going back to 1934, to one of the greatest air races in history, and to two stories inside it, a purpose-built racing machine that won and a commercial airliner that nearly stole the whole show. Today's program comes to you from aviationsoul.com. Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Now, 1934. The world was 27 years past Kitty Hawk and somewhere between wonder and intoxication about what aviation had become. The golden age was in full swing. Air racing was the most exciting sport on the planet. Newspapers couldn't print stories fast enough. People lined fences at aerodromes to watch machines go by that 5 years earlier, no one had believed were possible in Australia. The city of Melbourne was preparing to celebrate its 100th anniversary. A local candy manufacturer named Sir McPherson Robertson decided he wanted to mark the occasion in a way that would put Melbourne on every front page in the world. He announced an air race, England to Australia, £10,000 for the winner of the speed category, another £2,000 for the handicap Think about what that means in 1934. No global communications network, no satellite weather, no radar coverage across the Timor Sea or the Australian interior. Dead reckoning, a compass, whatever radio aids happen to exist along the route, and your own judgment. If you got lost over the outback at night, you were lost. That was the deal every crew accepted when they lined up at Mildenhall. The de Havilland Company in England decided this race deserved a purpose-built aircraft. Geoffrey de Havilland and his engineering team sat down in early 1934 with one goal in mind: win the Mac Robertson race. They had 9 months to design and build from scratch. 9 months. Today, that kind of timeline makes engineers laugh before they even finish the sentence, but Geoffrey de Havilland's team pulled it off. What they produced was the DH-88 Comet twin Gypsy 6 engines, each making about 230 horsepower. Retractable undercarriage, variable pitch propellers, which were still relatively new technology and gave the Comet a genuine advantage over anything flying fixed pitch props. A wooden fuselage so carefully fared and finished that the drag figures came in below what the wind tunnel had predicted. A cruise speed north of 200 miles per hour. That was extraordinary in 1934. The average commercial airliner of that era was doing perhaps half that. The DH-88 wasn't just fast, it was in a different category from almost everything else in the sky, and it looked the part, long and low and tapered. The fuselage narrowing toward the tail, like something drawn by someone who understood flow. Two seats side by side in a cockpit so tight that your shoulder was pressed against your co-pilot's. Fuel tank sized for the long legs between compulsory stops, but with margins that required respect. This was not an airplane that forgave carelessness in the fuel numbers. De Havilland built three of them for the race. GACSP, finished black, was called Black Magic. It was flown by Owen Cathcart-Jones and Ken Waller. GACSR was crewed by Jim Mollison and his wife, Amy Johnson Mollison. This was one of the most famous aviation couples in the world. Amy Johnson had made her name flying solo from England to Australia back in 1930. Jim Mollison had broken records across the Atlantic. Together, they were aviation royalty. If any crew could push a comet to its limit and come out the other side, it was those two. and GACSS was painted that deep, unmistakable red, registered to the Grosvenor House Hotel in London and entered by Arthur Octavius Edwards. It was crewed by Charles William Anderson Scott, known to everyone in the business as Scotty, and Tom Campbell Black. Scotty Scott was not new to this route. He had already flown solo from England to Australia and held the record. He knew what waited between the stop points, the heat shimmering over the plains of India, the monsoon zones near Singapore, the vastness of the Timor Sea, the flat brown featurelessness of the Australian interior where landmarks are few and the horizon goes on forever without offering you anything to fix on. He knew all of it. Tom Campbell Black had thousands of hours in difficult flying across Africa. The kind of pilot who had been in trouble before and had found his way out. Exactly who you want next to you across 11,000 miles. The race started at 6:21 in the morning. Aircraft departed at 45-second intervals to keep the field spread out. One by one they rolled across the Mildenhall grass and climbed out toward the southeast, toward Baghdad, toward everything that waited beyond. The Comets were immediately among the leaders. Their cruise speed set them apart from most of the field. But a race this long is not settled in the first hour or even the first day. Machinery fails, weather intervenes, navigation goes wrong. The fastest airplane in the field is not always the one that makes it to Melbourne. The Mollisons had difficulties and fell out of contention before the finish. Blackmagic ran into problems of its own. Of the three Comets that left Mildenhall, only Grosvenor House made it all the way, and Scott and Campbell Black made it count. Baghdad in under 7 hours. Allahabad in just over 22 hours from the start. Singapore by day two, Darwin well before the end of day three. At each stop, the turnaround was as fast as the rules and the machinery allowed. Top up the fuel, check the engines, eat something if there was time, and go. They were managing the airplane and managing themselves with a kind of quiet, focused precision, not pushing beyond what the machine could give, but never giving it less than it needed. The Red Comet over Australia, descending toward Flemington Racecourse, and then the wheels on the ground. 70 hours, 54 minutes, and 18 seconds from Mildenhall. The crowd had been growing at Flemington all day. When Grosvenor House appeared overhead and set up for landing, the noise was tremendous. Scott and Campbell Black climbed out of that tight cockpit into October sunshine, and the kind of moment you don't forget. They had won the McRobertson Air Race. That was the headline, and it should have been the whole story, except it wasn't, because making its way toward Melbourne, still flying, was a KLM Douglas DC-2. Registration PHAU. Its call sign was Iver in Dutch, that means stork. Now here's where it gets interesting. The UIver was not a racing machine. It was a commercial airliner and regular scheduled service for KLM, the Dutch national airline. Before the race, it had been flying paying passengers on European routes. It had seats in the back, a mail hold, everything a 1934 commercial transport carried. KLM entered the UIver as a demonstration. They wanted to show the world what modern commercial aviation could do. Captain Queen and Dirk Parmentier commanded the flight. First Officer Jan Mol flew right seat. They were steady, professional airline men, not racing pilots. And behind them in the cabin were three fare-paying passengers and a cargo of mail. Three passengers, actual paying customers, riding in a commercial airliner across 11,000 miles of the most demanding route aviation had yet attempted in competition. The Douglas DC-2 made this possible. Douglas had built something genuinely different in the early 1930s. All-metal monoplane construction. Retractable landing gear. Powerful radial engines. Modern aerodynamics. The DC-2 cruised at around 170 miles per hour, which sounds modest against the Comets, but in 1934 it was faster than almost anything that had ever flown a commercial schedule. The airliner world was in the middle of a transformation, and the DC-2 was the proof. Parmentier and Mol flew the same route as every other competitor. Stage by stage, running their schedule the way professional airline crews run a schedule, with discipline and the kind of steady attention to procedure that keeps machines and people alive over long distances. And then came the last night over Australia. Cloud had built over New South Wales. Rain was moving through. The UIver was running short on fuel and couldn't locate Albury, their next planned stop. The crew circled. The radio was confused. They were in trouble. In Albury, a town of perhaps 20,000 people in the New South Wales river country, people had been following the race on the wireless. When word came through that a Dutch airliner was somewhere overhead in the dark, circling and unable to find a way down, someone had an idea. They drove their automobiles to the Albury showgrounds. Every car they could gather, they arranged them around the oval and turned on their headlights. Think about that image. A ring of automobile headlights pointing up into an overcast sky, low and orange-yellow against the cloud base. Somehow, through the static, the local radio station established contact with the Overs radio operator. Instructions were relayed. Bearings given, the Dutch crew brought the airplane down. The field was soft from the rain. One main wheel dug in on landing, but the Over stopped without breaking anything and without anyone being hurt. The three passengers climbed out of the airliner onto the wet grass of a rural Australian showground, surrounded by a ring of automobile headlights and a crowd of strangers who had turned out in the middle of the night for a crew they had never met. They fueled from cans. They waited for the weather to lift, and then Parmentier and Moll flew on.
The Uever arrived at Flemington Racecourse in 90 hours and 13 minutes, second in the speed category. First overall in the handicap category, those three passengers had just completed the first fare-paying commercial flight from England to Australia in history. They had done it in the middle of a race with a forced landing in a paddock, fueled from cans, guided down by car headlights and a town radio station, but they had done it. Every airline executive who read those results understood something immediately. A commercial airliner in regular configuration, carrying mail and paying passengers, had finished in the top three against purpose-built racing machines in an international competition over 11,000 miles. And the DC-2 wasn't even Douglas's latest thinking. They were already developing the DC-3. If this was what the DC-2 could do in a race, the long-haul commercial aviation industry was about to change in ways the flying boat era had only hinted at. Pan Am was watching. Imperial Airways was watching. Every major airline in the world was watching. And at De Havilland, Jeffrey's team filed away everything they had learned. They had built a twin-engine wooden aircraft with clean aerodynamics and variable pitch propellers and proven it at the highest level of competition. Years later, when the Royal Air Force came looking for a fast twin-engine aircraft for a new role, De Havilland would draw on that body of knowledge. The aircraft they produced had two Rolls-Royce Merlin engines and a top speed approaching 400 miles per hour. You might know it better as the Mosquito. The Grosvenor House, GACSS, still exists. She's on display at the Shuttleworth Collection at Old Warden Aerodrome in Bedfordshire. Still that same deep red. Still one of the most beautiful airplanes ever built. The fact that she survived when so many aircraft of the era did not is almost as remarkable as the race itself. The Uever was not as fortunate. PHAU was lost to an accident in 1937. But what she demonstrated over 11,000 miles in October of 1934 still echoes in every long-range commercial flight since.
A candy manufacturer put up a prize. A team of engineers built a wooden racing aircraft in 9 months. Two airline pilots put a stock commercial airliner into a competition and nearly matched it. And the people of a small Australian town drove their cars to a paddock at midnight, turned on their headlights, and helped a crew find the ground. That is the golden age of aviation. Not just the engineering, not just the records, the human improvisation when things go sideways over the outback. The strangers who show up, that story draws from the original race coverage in Flight Magazine from October and November of 1934, and from the historical research of Graham Simons on the MacRobertson race. Notes are at radiohanger.com. I'm Taildragger, Clear Skies.